When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hi, I'm Shashank Bhargav, and you're listening to Three Things, the Indian Express news show. In this episode, we talk about new drugs that are being able to help people suffering from Alzheimer's disease. We also hear from the first Indian woman to complete the world's toughest race.
Consider that it is 40 plus degrees and you do not get any support from any race except a medical emergency situation.
But first, we talk about Manipur. Tensions in the northeastern state between the dominant Meitei community and the Kuki community have refused to simmer down. On Monday, for example, a mob set fire to some abandoned homes in Imphal that belonged to the members of the Kuki community, and some miscreants tried to force vendors in the area to shut shops. Since the tensions began on the 3rd of May, at least 70 have died, 200 have been injured, and thousands have been displaced. And these tensions have also halted the peace talks that had been going on between the central government and the 24 Kuki insurgent groups in Manipur. When we spoke to Indian Express's Esha Roy, she told us more about it.
So after the recent incidents, which began on May 3rd, when the Kuki Zomi tribes and the dominant Meitei community clashed with each other, you will feel the echoes of this for the coming possibly decade. The rift is unlikely to be healed soon. That's my feeling. Of course, what makes the situation a lot more complex is that the area where this first began, which is in Churachandpur district, there are 24 insurgent groups functioning in that area who are under suspension of operation, which means that they are not active, but they still do exist in camps there. As a matter of fact, Churachandpur district has the highest number of insurgent groups in one area in the entire state. These groups aren't as powerful as the NSE and IM, or the UNLF, which is a Meitei-centric group. But nevertheless, by virtue of the number of groups there are and by virtue of the fact that they are armed is what makes the situation particularly precarious and difficult for the government of India to handle.
Right, Anisha, because of these tensions, we know that their talks with the central government have come to a halt. And that means their conflict with the state will continue for some time. But could you talk about the kind of progress these talks had made and what had these insurgent groups been demanding?
So with the Kuki Zomi groups, the government was really progressing in its talks. They had made a lot of headway under the previous interlocutor, A.B. Mathur. You know, a basic agreement had already been in principle approved by both parties, by both the government of India and the groups, is my understanding. And what remained was, you know, just several sort of wrinkles to be ironed out. And the interlocutor for the Naga talks, A.K. Mishra, took over the talks with these insurgent groups recently. And he has also been very proactive. And actually, the insurgent groups have actually been very happy with the government of India and have been cooperating. So what these clashes have done, therefore, is it has changed the group's position. I mean, after decades of conflict with this Modi administration, convincing the groups that, look, a separate state is not viable, it is not beneficial for Manipur or even for the Kuki Zomi communities, the groups had actually dropped the demand for a separate state and willing to have a political situation within the geographical confines of Manipur, which now they have changed this position and the demand for a separate state has resurfaced once more.
And have we heard anything from the government since this happened? Do we know when these talks will resume now?
My understanding is that the talks had halted, but recently channels were opened unofficially. I mean, the government really couldn't do anything while the clashes were going on, while houses were being burned down and people were being displaced. That was the immediate situation that they needed to handle. But since things have calmed down, unofficially, channels have opened between the groups and the government, and there has been a bit of back and forth. And we believe that official talks are likely to resume very soon. But how the government will respond to this change of track by the Kuki insurgent groups in light of the developments, they're demanding a separate administration. They're not wanting to share a space, political or physical, with the Meitei community. That will just be conjecture. We'll have to see how the government deals with that new demand.
And what kind of hurdles do you think the government will face now? Because getting these insurgent groups to agree to your conditions, to bring them into the mainstream, one imagines is a big challenge, right?
Yeah, I mean, so Manipur has several secessionist movements from the time of independence. It's one of the oldest insurgency movements in India and arguably in the world. The tribes, as well as the Meiteis, who belong to the Manipuri kingdom called Kanglaikpak, have always contended that they were never a part of India, right? So that is where the conflict and the insurgency movement, that is where it's rooted in. But what the Kuki Zomi tribes over the years have diluted their demand, they've realized that this has not been particularly practical. And they have diluted their demands and have been negotiating with the government of India for a political solution within the territory, the political and geographic territory of Manipur. And their contention has always been that the Meitei-centric state government eats up all the funds, does not focus on development in the hill areas or the hill districts at all, and that it has traditionally been a communal government to the detriment of the tribals. But the government of India had managed to convince them over a period of time that, look, we'll look after you. We will ensure that there's development. There are possibly some packages which may have been discussed with the Kuki Zomi groups. You have to remember that all these talks are classified and confidential. So we don't know anything from the government. It's what we have gathered piecemeal from the groups.
Right. And one of the things you mentioned in your piece is that the government has assured these groups that they will get some kind of territorial councils. Could you explain what that is and what this would mean to the groups?
So what this means is that funds which are allotted to these extremely poor and underdeveloped districts cannot be touched by the state government and diverted to any work or any project in Imphal Valley. And this will ensure that there's a certain amount of development in these backward districts and also maybe the creation of employment opportunities here as well, because there are zero employment opportunities in the hill districts. So all of this negotiation was going on. And now the clashes, which are really more ethnic in nature, with the Kuki Zomis and the Meiteis on the other side, not wanting to give each other an inch. The Meiteis have contended that the tribals get a bigger share of the pie with reservations, that there are so many Kukis in the administrative services, in the Manipur police, in senior positions. So there's a lot of back and forth of allegations. So what the government will now have to do is, over a period of months, convince both sides that there is a solution by which both areas can be developed, both can be equally employed. The government will have to look at employment generation, which is a big issue in the state. They will have to ensure health facilities, education. It's really like they really have to think long term, I think, to solve the situation. Right now, what they need to do is simply try and resume talks and try and control the tensions that are there. That's all they can do, I think, this year. And then after that, they'll have to see how they can build a bridge between both the communities so that the Meitei dominant state government even accepts an agreement between the Sioux groups and the center.
And next, we talk about Alzheimer's disease. a brain disorder which affects millions of people around the world and for which there was no medicine available for decades. But this has been rapidly changing. Recently, in fact, just within a span of 1 year, two new drugs have been found to be effective in slowing down the cognitive decline in those suffering with early Alzheimer's. In this segment, we are joined by Indian Express's Anona Dutt, who reports on Health for the Paper about the significance of these new drugs. Anona, could you begin by talking about what exactly is Alzheimer's and what are its main symptoms?
So Alzheimer's is basically a type of dementia, and it's a brain disorder where memory of skills that you do, day-to-day things that you do, you slowly lose these abilities. I mean, it might start off with you being a little forgetful, forgetting where you're keeping your keys, or like forgetting whether you've had your lunch or not. And it progresses more and more till you forget to do the basic motor functions, like, you know, you forget how to walk, you forget how to talk, and anything that you do in your day-to-day life.
And how many people in India suffer from this disease?
So in India, the incidence of dementia has been going up, and researchers don't really know why. They are guessing it's some of it is environmental factors. Some of it is because our population is also now aging. We have a young population, but that average age is slowly going up. And with people living longer, you know, well into their 70s, 80s, people are more prone to getting these disorders. So that is why there has been an increase in dementia in the country. And the estimate, at least according to one of the estimates, it's supposed to be about 14 million dementia cases by 2050.
And could you talk about the kind of challenges that the scientific community has faced in trying to cure this disease and even just helping patients with it?
So at the moment, I mean, forget about cure. We don't even know why it happens. Okay. Researchers have been working on it for years on end, and there has been a lot of investment in curing dementia and Alzheimer's, but there hasn't been any significant result, say, in the last 50 years. We do not really understand why it happens. Everybody has a different theory on what causes it. And right now, in the last 2 years, we have seen three drugs coming up, and they have slowed the decline. So the decline is happening, but at a slower pace in people who take these drugs. And all these three drugs actually target these very particular thing that we see in the Alzheimer's brain. So if you take an MRI of the Alzheimer's brain, you can see these protein clumps forming. It's called an amyloid beta protein. And these unusual clumpings are a classic sign of Alzheimer's. And that is what these drugs attack. So they work in different mechanisms, but the end goal is to remove these plaque formations.
Yeah, and one of the two drugs that have come out this year is donanemab. Could you talk about the extent to which it has shown to slow down the cognitive decline in patients?
So donanemab trial that happened, they judged the patient over an 18-month period. And what they found that it slowed down the cognitive decline by 35%. And when they looked at the people's ability to do their day-to-day tasks, that decline was slowed by 40%. Now, this is significant from a carer's point of view, because once there is Alzheimer's, there is going to be a time when the patient is unable to do like simple tasks of eating their own food or going to the washroom by themselves. And, you know, even if you can slow that down for some time, that is a big help. Other than that, the study also found that there was no cognitive decline in 47% of the patients. So whatever their mental capacity was at the beginning of the 18 months, that was the same after 18 months in comparison to 29% of the people in the placebo group. So clearly there are some positive effects that the drug is having on the people with Alzheimer's. And I should mention here that the trial includes people who were in early stages of Alzheimer's, which is known as mild cognitive impairment.
Right. And besides donanemab, we've also seen lecanemab, which came out this year. And the extent to which they slow down the cognitive decline has been similar. There are, of course, differences, like when it comes to dosage. Lecanemab has to be given once in 2 weeks, while donanemab has to be administered once a month. But you know, for a while, there was nothing available in the market. How big of a deal are these latest drugs for the scientific community and people suffering from this problem?
So it's an exciting time because there is something that's coming out after, you know, putting money in research for years and years. And with, you know, most trials failing, no drug coming out of it. At the moment when you get Alzheimer's and if you catch it early on, the doctors just treat you with certain, you know, pills that would boost memory, but that doesn't really work so well. And it doesn't slow down the cognitive. You still have the cognitive decline. It's just, you know, some benefit. That's all. But here are three drugs that have been approved in the last 2 years, which actually have some impact in slowing down the cognitive decline. Of course, they cannot reverse the disease at the moment and they cannot cure the disease. But even the slowing down of the disease is quite a big excitement for, especially for neurologists who have been treating patients for years, not knowing what to do and, you know, what would be beneficial, what would not be beneficial, and a lack of treatments and therapies available. So there is excitement in the community. But again, when we're talking about, you know, new drugs, after approval from FDA, which donanemab still doesn't have, they still have to apply for their FDA approvals. It still takes some time for them to get approval in India. And even when they do, getting the drug can be challenging because it's likely to be very expensive.
And Anona, earlier you mentioned that we still don't know what causes the disease. But do we know if there are any ways to prevent it?
So Alzheimer's is now thought to be connected to the kind of lifestyle that we are leading. So doctors say if you want to, like, of course, if you are predisposed to Alzheimer's, you may get it, but you can delay that by having a better lifestyle, which is like sleeping your 8 hours a day, very important. Then having a healthy diet, exercising every day. These are the factors that will also bring down, say, incidence of diabetes and hypertension, etc., which might also be linked to making you more prone to the disease. But all in all, you have to have a good lifestyle. And they also suggest that you keep up with problem solving tasks, memory tasks. So, you know, solve puzzles or like learn a language or go out and meet people, form new connections. So when you keep doing this, you're also keeping your brain agile. So they suggest that you do all of this to prevent or delay Alzheimer's.
And finally, we talk about what is known to be the toughest race in the world. Earlier this month, Mahashweta Ghosh, a tech marketer from Gurgaon, became the first Indian woman to compete in the Marathon Disables, or MDS, a multi-stage, multi-day race held in the Moroccan Sahara Desert, one of the world's hottest terrains. Indian Express's Shivani Nayak had spoken to Ghosh, and she told her just how tough the race actually is.
Here we are talking about a race which is 7 days in nature. Every day is a race. That is why it is a multi-stage event, as it is called. And every day there is an event, so to say, where there is a start time, there's a flag off time, there is a finish time, and you have to finish it on within that time, else you do not go on to the next stage, number one. Number two is that it is unsupported, which means that they do not give you anything except plain water, which is what you get, that too in limited quantity of 12 liter per day. So your food, your anything so-called nutrition for the race, your breakfast, your lunch, your dinner, whatever you need, you just carry it all on you. They will not give you anything. Number three is that this is a race stage where every day you're moving from A location to B location, which means that you're carrying a backpack on you, which is carrying all your hydration, your nutrition stuff, your, you know, sleeping bag, your sleeping gear, your race gear, anything and everything you need for the 7 days, you carry it in that bag. People say you live out of a suitcase. Here you're actually living out of a bag in the desert, in the tent for the 7 days.
And this is what takes a physical and a mental toll on you. Ghosh says that each day, athletes are running close to 40 kilometers on a terrain that is filled with sand dunes.
When I say sand dunes, they're like sand mountains, which are 600, 700 meter high, which you have to climb. Temperatures were soaring, which was this time probably 40 plus. And then, of course, after the first 3 days, there is a fourth day, which they call the long day.
This long day is a 90-kilometer stretch, which participants have to finish within 36 hours.
Now, anybody might say, oh, 90 kilometer and 36 hours is just awesome, you know, you can do it so easily. But consider that it is 40 plus degrees. It is a terrain which is filled with either sand dunes or high mountains, which are extremely rocky, sharp rocks. Like people had their shoes ruptured in a lot of times. You're wearing gaiters. You're carrying a backpack, which is probably weighing like 8-9 kgs by that time. And you do not get any support from any race except a medical emergency situation. Now, on that day, which was the day 4th, which is the 90-kilometer day when I set out from the camp, I wanted to finish the race before I rested. So I actually started on the day 4 in the morning, and through 23 hours, I walked and ran completely to complete the distance and finish back to the tent. Which meant that there was a big portion of this day which I actually ran during the night, which is post-sunset till sunrise in the morning when I came back to the camp.
She says that this part of the race was the toughest for her. Out of 10, she says she would give it an 11.
At night, the desert is pitch dark. All you can see is only through your headlamp, which doesn't reflect too far as it is all sand, right? So you can only see to a shorter distance. You can, of course, make out markers which are reflectors from a distance which you can see. That's how you can make out the route. Alternatively, you have a race book on you which you can refer to in case you're confused or you get lost. And you have a compass on your watch or on you. The second thing is it is completely still. Because there is sand, there is nothing that is moving in the air. There are no trees. There are no insects which are flying. You do not hear any noise. It is literally like you are in space and it is vacuum. And that stillness kind of was engulfing. And there was a stage when I first experienced this, and that was very, very distressing.
She says that at that point, she had also exhausted a lot of her food that she had been eating during the day. So while running at night, all she had was water to keep her going.
I could have taken out food from another day pack and eaten, which was the next day, but that meant that that day I wouldn't have anything to eat. So I just remember I had some backup. I had taken some plain oats, which was like oats powdered. I put that in the glass I carried. I put some plain salt into it. I poured water and I drank it, which honestly now as comfortably I'm able to say it, at that state of mind and body, I really had like almost tears in my eyes to drink it. It was really that difficult.
And it wasn't just the lack of food that was the problem. She says that during the race, she also ended up injuring her left foot while coming down a sand dune.
So my left ankle was swollen and had like a big red patch. So I got very scared, saying I don't know if I injured myself. And my right foot obviously had a lot of blisters. So my right foot was hurting and my left foot was hurting. And then the whole, you know, the psyche of all this distress. I think that part of the race was really, really tough, and I will not shy away from saying that that part of the race was the toughest thing I have ever done in my life.
Now, while this kind of terrain might seem frightening to some people, Ghosh says that she fell in love with this kind of sandy terrain when she ran the 75-kilometer Pokhran Marathon in Rajasthan over 3 years ago.
Of course, it was a one-day stretch and nothing more. When I did that race and I came back to Gurgaon, a friend of mine actually showed me the Netflix series called Losers, where I first got to know about MDS. While I did Pokhran, I realized that I absolutely loved the terrain, that there is a certain beauty about it. It challenges you in ways which are very different and I hadn't experienced when I ran in other terrains.
Now, talking about what it takes to prepare for a race like this, Ghosh says that there are three aspects to it: the physical, the mental, and the logistical.
So smart choices are very, very important. Like, for example, food. My bag on day one was weighing 11.5 kgs, of which 50% was food. Like, everyday food is 600-700 grams, and 2,000 calories is a must-have each day. So I remember I started with preparing, first eating food that I thought I could eat each day. So I then made a list of these things. Then I put them into a template of saying that, okay, this is how the food I'm able to eat. Then my nutritionist put them into calorie counts. And then we started to revisit that, saying, okay, what is the food which is the maximum calorie and the lowest weight? Because weight is the biggest thing that mattered. Even 10 grams is crucial. Like, so, you know, jokingly, I actually cut off the toothbrush by half because it even that would reduce some amount of weight. So prepping that food, and I remember I packed my bag like 4 times to ensure that, okay, I have packed. Now, what is it that I can remove? What is it that I can remove? What is it can I remove? Can I replace this with that? And so on and so forth. Like, for example, the sleeping bag that I had was weighing 800 gram. But then I realized that 800 gram is like a kg of weight we are talking about. And here, some total, you know, you don't want to carry more than 9-10 kgs. I still had 11.5. So then I found out, saying, okay, where is the sleeping bag? So, and then I ordered in the last minute. I remember I ordered a sleeping bag from UK, which weighs like 280 grams. So getting all of these together, it is not just a race that you can just get up and do it tomorrow. The 256 distance is not what makes it hard. But the whole combination of all these factors together makes it the toughest race in the world, probably.
You were listening to Three Things by The Indian Express. Today's show was edited and mixed by Suresh Pawar and produced by Rahil Philippos, me, Shashank Bhargav, and Shivani Nayak, who had originally spoken to Mahashweta Ghosh. If you like the show, then do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, you can also leave us a review or a comment. Our team reads all of them. You can also recommend the show to someone you think will like it. Share it with a friend or someone in your family. It's the best way for people to get to know about us. You can also tweet us at Express Audio and write to us at podcast@indianexpress.com.